Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who takes a critical look at President Bush's June 28th speech, where he pledged to stay the course in the increasingly unpopular Iraq War. Joanne Sheehan of the War Resisters League, who talks about the complex economic issues dealt with by communities hit by military base closings. And journalist Joanne Wipajewski, who assesses the looming civil war inside the AFL-CIO and what's at stake for working people. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
6 months after the massive Indian Ocean tsunami, the government of Sri Lanka is preparing for a political storm as it announced a deal in late June to distribute aid with the ethnic rebel Tamil Tigers, who control much of the northeast of the country. Several of the coalition partners of President Chandrika Kumaratunga are protesting the new aid plan. A few weeks ago, one coalition member, the Marxist People's Liberation Front, quit the government because of the cooperative agreement with the Tamil Tigers. The United Nations has estimated that half of the nation's fishing fleet was destroyed by the tsunami. Now fishermen are banking on a $3 billion aid package to get back to work. In recent months, aid has been bottlenecked in Sri Lanka due to the lack of cooperation between the government and the Tamil Tigers, who have been engaged in a 20-year war for independence that has left 65,000 people dead. Now, many outside observers hope the deal mediated by Norwegian Foreign Minister Jan Petersen can lead to a broader peace accord. Yet progress will likely be slow as protests mount against the cooperation deal. Ghana farmer Rakia Salifu works all day harvesting rice with her baby strapped to her back, yet she barely makes enough to provide food for her five children. Over the last generation, the rice market in Ghana has collapsed. According to the Guardian newspaper, critics blame the struggle of local farmers on structural adjustment loans given to Ghana by the International Monetary Fund in the early 1980s. Conditions attached to the loans mandated the import of cheap rice subsidized by the U.S. and European governments. In cities like Accra, Charles Yeboah refuses to sell Ghana rice because it costs more and is a lower quality than the subsidized imports. The declining rice crop has also led to a massive flow of migrants into urban centers where many hungry women and children sleep on the streets. As part of the Make Poverty History campaign directed at the leaders of the G8 industrialized nations, the development group Oxfam asserts that the plight of the rice farmers in Ghana illustrates how Western policies and agricultural subsidies are destroying the livelihoods of farmers in poor nations in Africa and around the globe. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that anti-gay violence boiled over at Jerusalem's annual Gay Pride Parade on June 30th. An ultra-Orthodox man broke through a police line near the Great Synagogue and stabbed three gay rights marchers. The city's ultra-Orthodox mayor, Yuri Lupolianski, had tried to ban the gay pride gathering, but days before the march, a court ordered the city to issue permits for the parade, decorate the streets with rainbow banners, and pay $13,000 in damages to Jerusalem Open House, the group organizing the march. Open Door director Hage Elad blamed the violence on Mayor Lupolianski. Overall, 13 people were arrested, including two members of the Knesset, who sat in the middle of King George V Street to block the march. Controversy has surrounded gay events in Jerusalem for months. A diverse coalition of Muslim, Jewish, and Christian leaders came together to call for the cancellation of World Pride, an event slated for Jerusalem in August. It was postponed until next year because it conflicted with the Israeli pullout from Gaza. Jerusalem's Gay Pride Parade attracted a record 8,000 marchers, including gay civil servants and Palestinian youth who are afraid to express their gay sexuality in the occupied territories. As organizer Hage Elad observed, many of our participants are religious or conservative. What the marchers are expressing is not sexual identity, but their belief in pluralism and diversity. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
In the face of declining public support for the war in Iraq, and growing doubts about the justification for the invasion and occupation, President Bush addressed the nation in a televised speech on June 28th to make a case for staying the course in the conflict. Using hundreds of soldiers at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, as a backdrop, the president asserted that the sacrifice of U.S. lives in Iraq is worth it, and it is vital to the future security of our country. Mr. Bush rejected any timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops and offered no new strategies for winning the war against an insurgency that daily seems to grow in strength and sophistication. The president's only exit strategy is based on his hope that one day U.S.-trained Iraqi soldiers will be able to take over for American occupation forces. In an echo of Mr. Bush's use of the 9/11 attacks to justify the Iraq invasion, the president invoked the 2001 terrorist attacks five times in his speech to defend his decision to go to war. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA analyst. McGovern was among a group of administration critics who testified before a June 17th unofficial congressional hearing investigating the British Downing Street memos, which many observers believe provides evidence of the dishonest White House justification for launching its invasion of Iraq. McGovern takes a critical look at President Bush's recent national address and his strategy for fighting the Iraq war.
I think that the editors of the New York Times said it best the morning after that speech, where they said that they were shocked that the president would, in their words, quote, raise the bloody flag of 9/11 over and over again to justify a war in a country that had nothing whatsoever to do with the terrorist attacks, end quote. Well, in the article I wrote that same morning, I gave the Times kudos for the insight, but complained that it came 3 years too late. The president, with no doubt the encouragement of Karl Rove, has used 9/11 in an incredibly cynical way to wage this war on Iraq. Most people, I dare say, if you took a survey today, there would be at least 50% of the American people who believe that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. By mentioning it five times in this speech, the president certainly wanted to cultivate that notion, and I find that despicable, because now we're in a quagmire for sure. Now when Americans are asking for answers, how are we going to get out of Iraq? When will we get out of Iraq? Defense Secretary says, well, it might be 12 years. Vice President says, well, they're in their last throes, those terrorists. Whom are we to believe? Why is there no discussion of this? Back during Vietnam, we had William Fulbright, prominent Democrat head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Who do we have now? Well, unfortunately, we have Joe Biden, who was wrong on the war from the beginning, and it continues to be wrong on the war. Nobody seems to have lived through the experience of Vietnam. Nobody seems to realize that these same things were said at the same time in the war of Vietnam. And so what we need to do here, very simply, is to recognize two things. Number one, we have to be honest. And we have to say, what's going to happen if we pull out our forces? We don't know. It is impossible to say. Okay? Number two, what's going to happen if we keep our forces in the numbers that they're now in there? Well, we do know the answer to that. 2 years from now, 4 years from now, 6 years, maybe even 12 years from now, the situation will be at least as bad as it is now and probably worse. So we have two choices. We can, quote, stay the course and send still more cannon fodder into this calculus and incur still more enmity throughout the Muslim world, and there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, I'd remind your audience, or we can try to figure out imaginative ways to get out of there. And the imaginative ways have to start with two premises. One is the president has to publicly disavow any intent to have permanent military bases in Iraq. He hasn't been willing to do that. He needs to do that. And number two, the president needs to promise that he will compete just like any other country for the oil that lies under the sands of Iraq. Once those two things are acknowledged, then our European friends, then our friends in India, and friends around the world will say, all right, the U.S. is serious now. Let us see if we can help them. Let us see if we can fill in behind them. Let us keep them to their commitments for economic aid to repair the damage. Let's put the UN back in and help these factions sort things out. Then we'll get the international help that is necessary to solve this thing. But if we don't do that, if we say we're going to stay the course, we're just going to stay there until we get them all trained up, well, that's Vietnam all over again.
I wanted to ask you about Iraq and its future, given that the Shia majority has control of the government right now. At the very same time, the United States is rattling sabers at the government of Iran for what they say is its role in the axis of evil and its possible nuclear weapons program. The members of the government of Iraq seem to be fast friends with the Iranian regime, and ironically, it looks like the government the United States helped to install in Iraq may become an ally of a U.S. enemy, a U.S. declared enemy. What are your thoughts?
You know, it's the height of folly for U.S. policy planners to be planning on giving the majority power to the Shia, because the Shia, as you know, are very much penetrated by Iranian intelligence. And if the Shia end up in a sort of a position of predominance juridically now with a new government and all that, well, they will be no friends to the United States, given their close identification with Iran. And Iran will have as much influence in what happens in that part of Iraq as the United States does. And that's the supreme irony here. These folks, one might conclude, really don't know what they're doing, these folks being the neoconservatives who are running our policy.
That was 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who, until his retirement in 1990, led one of two CIA teams conducting the most secret daily intelligence briefings at the White House. His recent article, Stay the Crooked Course, can be read online at www.truthout.org. From the 1960s to the present, the U.S. military has gone through several rounds of base closings and realignments, with the dual purpose of saving money and forging a modern military able to respond to the latest actual and perceived threats. In May 2005, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld submitted to the Independent Bipartisan Base Closure and Realignment Commission, or BRAC, a list of bases that the department has selected for closure. The Navy submarine base in Groton, Connecticut, is the oldest sub-base in the country and the largest facility proposed for closure in terms of personnel, with between 8,500 and 10,000 jobs lost if the base shuts down. The BRAC Commission determined the list based on the military value of the facilities. Connecticut politicians at the local, state, and federal levels are now scrambling to convince the commission that the sub-base is too valuable to shut down. On September 8th, the BRAC Commission will make its own base closure recommendations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joanne Sheehan, Northeast staff person for the War Resisters League and chair of War Resisters International, the parent organization. She lives near the Groton sub-base and talks about the 15 years she's been working on economic conversion issues, attempting to move away from dependence on military programs and toward sustainable community development.
The Community Coalition for Economic Conversion got started really in the early 1990s when the first George Bush decided to cut the Seawolf program at the end of the Cold War. And it was very clear at that point in time that electric boat, General Dynamics Electric Boat, which was the maker of that program, was not interested in economic conversion. They, in fact, had turned away $3 million of money offered them by the state of Connecticut and the state of Rhode Island. And so we began to really look at what can a community do to provide jobs for people. And so we were really looking at community economic development goals. Community economic development goals would include really that economic security, concerned about ecological quality and concerned about economic quality, really good jobs, concerned about economic empowerment. How much does the local economy have control? You know, initially when we found out that the sub-base was on the BRAC list, it felt like 110% of the energy was going into saving the base. I would say in the last few weeks there's been more, at least articles in the paper saying, look, we need to be considering a plan B. We need to be looking at alternatives. We need to look at case studies of other military bases that were closed in previous rounds and what was successful. How did it work? How did they, in fact, many of them, I think there are 27 of them, who have actually been able to create as many jobs as they lost, and that there are certain factors that go into that process. But it's hard for people in a community that has been so dependent on the military, and this community has been dependent on the military for many years, many, many decades, not just from the sub-base, but from Electric Boat, from other subcontractors. It's hard for people to imagine change. And what we found in the early 90s, it was hard for people to imagine change that could be really any better. And so instead of trying to hold meetings and do the kind of classic organizing, we went out and did a listening project community survey on economic conversion. We had 24 questions that we asked 75 people in the community. That group of 75 was a cross-section of folks who were workers, who were business owners, who were people in nonprofits, people in social services, a lot of people whose voices were not being heard. And in that, we found that people felt this was a good place to live, but they didn't really know what else people could be doing in this community, that there were no models of community economic development, that we'd been a community that, for as long as anybody could remember, kind of held our hand out to the military and said, give us jobs. And I think another thing that's a concern is that people didn't feel that as ordinary citizens we had any ability to have input into any decisions. So that even though the sub-base is in Groton, it really affects the whole community. But the community doesn't have a kind of leadership structure and doesn't have folks who have provided this kind of leadership. One of the things that people said, even though there was not a specific question on that listening project, they said, this community needs a vision and it needs regional planning. And we still, to this day, don't have that.
If the base does close, what do you think should happen to it?
Well, I think the base should be cleaned to the point where it can be used as a job site. And I think actually the cleaning of the base can provide a lot of jobs, probably for a long period of time.
As a member of the War Resisters League and a peace activist, you're not in favor of trying to save the base, but what are you in favor of?
My feeling would be I would like to see this BRAC process be much more of a real disarmament process as opposed to a simply shifting around kind of a process. In terms of what the future may hold, there are people in War Resisters League, in the Southeastern Connecticut for Peace and Justice, who have begun to have some conversations about what role could we play in trying to help create a vision of this community that would help influence what could be done at that sub-base. And to particularly, in a way, I think that the Community Coalition for Economic Conversion did in the early 1990s is help bring some of the kind of models for how this can be done by a community with the participation of people in the community to have some say over this resource, which has really belonged to the taxpayers for so many years. So I think that would be our emphasis, would be on the community's involvement in a process so that something can be created there that really does provide a kind of sense of security and benefits for the community, not just for a small number of people.
That was Joanne Sheehan of the War Resisters League. Call the league at area code 212-228-0450 or visit their website at www.warresisters.org. Years ago, John Sweeney, decrying the declining fortunes of the U.S. labor movement, demanded sweeping change in the moribund leadership of the AFL-CIO. Sweeney succeeded and was elected the Union Federation's president. Among other reforms, he promised more resources for organizing to reverse the union movement's declining membership. A decade later, Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union and a one-time protege of Sweeney at SEIU, is challenging his old boss with many of the same demands for reform and substantive change in the way labor is organized. Stern, along with four other unions representing 5 million members, are calling for the merger of smaller unions in key industries, a reduction in the AFL's central staff, and a rebate of millions of dollars back to Federation members earmarked for strategic organizing. The Reform Alliance, calling itself the Change to Win Coalition, is made up of SEIU, the Teamsters, Apparel and Hotel Workers Union, Unite Here, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and the Laborers. As the AFL-CIO prepares to meet for its July 25th convention, Stern has received authorization from the SEIU Executive Board to walk out of the Federation if core demands for reform are not met. Other unions in his coalition may follow suit. Critics contend that a split in the labor movement during a time of sustained attacks from a Republican president in Congress would be disastrous, while Stern supporters believe dramatic action is justified. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joanne Wipajewski, a journalist who has covered the labor movement for 20 years. She discusses labor's looming civil war and what's at stake for working people in this struggle.
The membership is at the lowest level in about 60 years. It's only 12.5% of the workforce, and if you factor out the public sector, that is government jobs, it's only about 8%. Of the private sector. So that's really bad. That's really bad. And everybody is very upset about this and very anxious and worried because the condition of organized labor really is a kind of barometer for the rest of society. And I think it's important to sort of see the current situation as the end of a 30-year arc which has shown us a pretty relentless assault on labor from a combination of government and corporate forces. I mean, beginning in the late 1970s, there was essentially a capital strike. I mean, companies began demanding concessions, began demanding givebacks, began doing something then in the 1980s with the entrance of Ronald Reagan to the presidency of replacing striking workers. 20,000 people at least are fired every year just for trying to have a union. Now, that's basic freedom of association. That's part of the Bill of Rights. The 20,000 people get fired every year, and those are the government statistics, so it could be much higher. The way it's redounded to the rest of us, all of us who might not be in unions, is that when you don't have an organized working class, when you don't have a force fighting to raise standards, raise wages, get back part of the goodies and reclaim the value of their labor, you have an assault on wages everywhere.
There is a challenge now to the current AFL-CIO leadership under John Sweeney. Andy Stern and some other many millions of members of other allied unions are threatening to split from the AFL-CIO, openly challenging the leadership of John Sweeney. Maybe you can address what you think went wrong, because after all, John Sweeney was a dissident within the AFL-CIO and came in and challenged the established leadership there, what was it, 10 years ago?
Yes.
So what happened, and why are we now at a place where John Sweeney's drive to change unionism in this country failed, and now a new set of dissidents are challenging him?
You know, the Stern challenge and the challenge of some of his cohorts, who were very dicey people, It's another turn on change to organize, organize to change. I mean, it's now they have something called the Change to Win Coalition. And they say the unions are, you know, there are too many unions. There should be a few really large ones. And that if they're really large and they're really focused on industry, you know, they'll be more successful. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. But does anyone really think that if the Teamsters as a union is bigger and richer, it will be better? Does anyone think that the UFCW, which is the United Food and Commercial Workers, a pretty dreadful union, very big, also part of the so-called dissident faction, that if it has more numbers and more money, it'll be a better union? I mean, it doesn't know how to service the members it currently has. It sells them out. It negotiates terrible contracts. The Teamsters are still involved in corruption. I mean, I think that unions haven't been honest with themselves. I don't think they've been honest with themselves about what their public profile is, what their relationship to their own members is, what their relationship to the larger working class is. The unions have not figured out a way not only how to organize and mobilize their own members for political change and political power, but the class at large.
Joanne, as far as the challenge coming up at the July 25th AFL-CIO convention, as far as that challenge goes from Andy Stern and the rest to the leadership of John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, do you foresee some positive change coming out of this, or do you fear that an eventual split of the AFL-CIO, which has been threatened by Andy Stern and others, could really set back labor even further than it has in the last bunch of years?
I don't see any good coming, but I have to say. I don't see any good come of it because I don't see anything interesting or fundamentally radical or challenging or creative or imaginative coming from the side that's supposedly anointed itself the future of labor. Andy Stern has been saying for some time that he wants to, quote, blow up the AFL-CIO, and he has an authorization from his executive council to do just that. And he very well may. They have had plans, SEIU has had plans since 2004 to pull out, and this creation of the Change to Win coalition, Andy Stern and the other unions are going to put money and infrastructure and staff to, seems like it's shaping up to be some kind of alternative federation, alternative homes for those unions who may want to depart from the AFL. Now, you know, there are people who say, oh, well, you know, anything is better than what we've got because, look, there's only 12.5% of the workforce. Well, yeah, but this is also time for defensive moves, and that's not to say that there shouldn't be some smart offense because there certainly should be, but we have to face facts, and this is the most hostile administration to labor, even more so than the Reagan administration. I mean, the most hostile administration to labor that anyone can remember.
That was Joanne Wipajewski, a columnist for Mother Jones magazine. Read her article titled The Days of Bread and Roses in the July-August edition of Mother Jones, or visit the publication's website at www.motherjones.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Linda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.